All right, tonight we're beginning our study on the backstory to the story of Jesus. And let me just kind of give you something of a rationale for it, what my thoughts are behind it. As we have the past several months been studying the Gospel of John, we see many things happening. We see cities being discussed, towns, events, people, all these things going on. And in particular, the Gospel of John is a very richly theological book in which much theology is really presumed. You should know a lot about the Old Testament history, the way the Jews of the first century thought, what they believed, if you're going to fully understand what the Gospel of John is all about. So at the one level, we can say the Gospel of John is rather easy, and so we recommend new believers read the Gospel of John. You can read and hear its message. But at a very different level, it's actually quite complex, quite deep and rich, and theologically challenging. And so having a deeper background knowledge of the story is helpful in not only understanding it, but of interpreting it. Now, we all know that we have to read and understand the scriptures in its context. And so we talk about the Bible's context. When we talk about the context, often we're thinking about the literary context. In other words, if we're going to read John chapter 5, it's helpful to have read John chapter 4 and chapter 3 before it to kind of get the flow of where it's going. Interpreting Paul's epistle to the Philippians, for example, you don't begin in chapter 3. You want to know what chapter 1 and 2 had to say to see it in its context. And so the literary context does matter. But often, even more beyond that, we have to understand it in its historical context. The Bible happened at a time and a place very, very different from ours. Even today, those of us who are 50 plus or older, you look back in time, back to your youth, and you say, you lived in a very different time, a very different place. We didn't do things like that when I was a kid, or people did things differently. And that was only 30, 40, 50 years ago. Now, in coming to the scriptures, we're moving back 2,000 and 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. So there's a lot of history behind it that's very different from the world we live in. The world is very different. The people are very different. The cultures are very different. The languages are different. So all of these are the ways in which we have to contextualize, understand the scriptures in those contexts. And that becomes challenging because in order to be a good student of the New Testament, you have to be well versed in the Old Testament. You have to understand what the Old Testament is about. And that means you also have to understand something about the ancient Near East, about the Mesopotamian Valley, about Egypt, and these other places. Who were these people? How did they live? Because the world of the Israelites involved them in Mesopotamia, where Abraham was called from Ur of the Chaldees. He left the Mesopotamian Valley near Samaria and came through the Fertile Crescent down into Israel. Well, the Fertile Crescent, now we're talking about geography. And so understanding the scriptures, it helps to understand geography. The New Testament itself with the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what are called the Synoptic Gospels because they look so alike, you can lay them side by side and see them at the same time. There's many, many parallels. But in those Gospels, we see Jesus moving around in different ways. But they seem to have Jesus moving from the outer skirts in Galilee and around and then towards Judea into Jerusalem where he's crucified. And so the story seems to be all bound up within 1 year. And as you read through those Gospels, you see Jesus in Galilee first and then moving around, but he begins to circle and move towards Jerusalem. But the Gospel of John, as we've seen it, tells a story including different information so that we have Jesus in chapter 2 and chapter 3, boom, he's in Jerusalem, then he's out of Jerusalem, then he's back again for another festival, then out again. And so it shows us that Jesus' ministry went probably 3 years because there were at least three Passovers that he went to in the Gospel of John. We're just now getting towards the final Passover, as we'll see. And so these are the contexts in the world in which we need to understand it. Even thinking about the biblical law that we talked about in Exodus of Moses, understanding the biblical law, we can do that with the background information of understanding the Babylonian law, what they had in hand, the Assyrians, the Hittites also. In fact, as we'll see shortly tonight, the Hittite world, which is in part of modern-day Turkey, but that whole Anatolian plateau had law there. The treaties that it had are well preserved, and they parallel and show us to help us understand what the book of Deuteronomy is about. The book of Deuteronomy itself follows the Hittite treaty formula. And fortunately for ancient scholars, the scholars of the ancient world, in the ancient world, when they didn't have pen and paper and parchment and papyri, they had the chisel or with a knife, and they carved in clay. And clay lasts forever. And so the record of the ancient world in that time frame, from the Assyrians and the Hittites, the Babylonians, Nineveh, and all of those, much of that's preserved in the clay tablets. And so much of that world survives very well. There's a large gap of it that happens when people stop writing on clay and start writing on parchment. That begins to degrade and fade away. And the only parchment we have left basically comes from the dry desert regions of Egypt, or perhaps even the Dead Sea Scrolls, which aren't contaminated by water. So archaeology plays a part in understanding of the world. Geology plays a large part as well. The geography plays a large part. We'll talk about the geography of Israel. But when you look at a flat map, you don't see anything but, you know, Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea here, the River Jordan between it, and then cities spotted around. When you look at a relief map that shows you how the hills are, where they're at, where the plain is, it gives you a very different view of how people moved around in the world in which they lived. We can think also of, like, marriage. You think about the ancient Near East. When we read about marriage in the Bible, we want to sometimes project into it our own understanding of romance and love and family and all of that. Well, that wasn't a part of marriage in the ancient world for much of its millennia. The people there didn't have love and marriage in that regard. They had arrangements for family purposes and for treaty and some of those sort of things. So marriage is very different. Slavery. We read about slavery in the scriptures, but slavery in the ancient world was not based on ethnic oppression or bigotry. It was, in fact, based on economics, and it was an economic thing, and there were other parts to it. Slaves were treated differently than you might think about slaves being treated in the American South. Many slaves in the ancient world treated far, far better, some even far worse. But these are the worlds in which all this happens. When you think about the cities of the ancient world, we talk about the city of Jerusalem and on and on. We can easily begin to project back our idea of what a city is, like the city of Denver. Well, the city of Jerusalem was relatively small. Tens of thousands of people lived there. Any smaller town in Colorado might be more representative. When the Passover happened, you might have had an influx of 100,000 people, but those people come would then fill it. But the ancient cities are of different dimensions and sizes. So when you think about the city of Nineveh and others, they could be walled off. You could put a wall around the city. So this is some of the stuff that we want to talk about to kind of get a feel of it. All of this is basically the idea of translating. We know we have to translate the Hebrew scriptures or the Greek scriptures into English so that we can read them. And so we're fortunate to have scholars that can do that, that can translate these ancient languages into readable English texts. But in addition to having at hand an English text we can read, we also need to translate the cultures of that world and the religions of that world, to know what those were about so we can put those into our own context. So for that, we need the help of those who are experts. Now, we like to think of the Bible as being a timeless book that's clear in what it says, and we can read it and see that in many places it is quite clear in what it says. But a lot of times, in our own minds, we're misconstruing its meaning or distorting its meaning because we're projecting our own world onto it, interpreting it in light of our own thinking, when we have to always remember that the Bible was not written to us. It was written to somebody else. It was written for us, and so it's for our benefit, but it's not written to us. The Bible was written, when the books were written, they were written to a different people, a different world, a different culture. And so we want to understand how those first readers would have thought, would have understood, would have read and understood what those passages were all about. And so we do need the help. And that's why good study Bibles can often help a lot in our understanding. They explain some of the nuance. But there are other good study aids as well that you might have access to. Introductions to the Old Testament, the New Testament as well, that can explain some of this background information. In fact, there's a number of different series out, publications on this sort of background cultural information that people are now publishing, publishing houses are doing, and people are accessing. So let's begin with our idea of where this all starts in the Scriptures. When we think about what the Scriptures are, we know that God had a plan for Israel. And when you open up the Bible, you find very quickly in Genesis 1 a story there that continues on for many chapters, but the story continues on with the story and soon becomes the story of Israel and God's plan for Israel. But as we open up the Scriptures, we see that we have a sovereign God, a God who's sovereign. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Bible begins with the idea that there is a God who creates, a God who acts. Psalm 89 we'll talk about later. The heavens are yours, the earth also is yours. The world and all it contains, you have founded them. So the Bible is replete with information that God is sovereign, God creates, God's in control. But we know also that early on God reveals that he wants to exercise his sovereignty in a world in which there is humanity. And so he creates the world in which people now exist. And he reveals this to us in the Scriptures. And so we know that our first parents, Adam and Eve, created in the garden. They're given this place. They're given a job, meaningful work. They're given the responsibility to fill and subdue this garden. So this is where their job is. And then at the end of chapter 1, it says that God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, we know there's basically two parallel creation stories. The first begins in chapter 1 and goes through chapter 2, verse 3 or 4. That's a story of the cosmic design of the universe as God creates this cosmic world. Then chapter 2 begins the discovery, the discussion of God's interest in humanity as Adam and Eve and humanity is now created. When you think about creation, though, it's easy for us to get stuck on the wrong point. Now, many people read the creation narrative and see in it a scientific description of how God created. Instead, I think if we think about how the ancient world would read and hear and understand what's going on, they wouldn't see it so much as a scientific description of what God is doing, but more of a theological, literary explanation of what God wants, what God is about. So the creation narratives are less about the when and the how and more about the why and the who. It's about God creating the who and the why because he wants to engage in a world with humanity. And so creation is seen throughout the Scriptures, as we'll see, as basically God's temple. We see this then echoed in the description of how to make the tabernacle and the temple later. But it is a description of God creating this sacred space. In the ancient world, they often thought about, if you take the Israelites and others, before Abraham was told about God, he too was a polytheist. There's many gods, and the gods of the ancient worlds were basically aligned with the forces of nature. So, for example, in the Babylonian mythology, there's Marduk, the god of the storm, which if you live in Babylon or in other places, the god of the storm is a good god. You need the rain. That's where the life of the earth comes from, is from Marduk, that god. We also see Baal and Bel and other gods of the Babylonian world show up in the Scriptures. But in the ancient way of thinking, these gods were out there and we needed their help. And so what the ancients did then was to build temples, for example, so that they could have a place for their gods to come down so they could serve the gods, not because the gods were benevolent as such, but because in the ancient world they thought they needed to do something good for the gods, so the gods returned that favor. And so if I sacrifice to Marduk, the god of the storm, then maybe Marduk will make it rain, that'll be good for me. And so all that goes on in the ancient world is done for the gods only so that they can manipulate the gods and have the gods now do something more for them. But when we see the Genesis story, we see this very differently. This is a picture of how God now is creating a place, a temple, for God to dwell with humanity. And so it's been described like this. We can talk about the building of a home. And maybe if you're talking about a home like Frank Lloyd Wright, you want to talk about the architecture of it, how it was built, where the plumbing is, where the windows are, and all of that. You can talk about the architecture of that. But in general, we don't think of the house in that regard. We think of it not as a house, but we think of it as our home. And that's what Genesis is talking about. Genesis creation accounts is talking about a home for God to be with humanity. The house that I live in now, I bought from my mom, which she and my dad bought in 1969. So I was 7 years old when I first moved into that house. Now, since then, it's been rebuilt many ways. I stripped out many of the walls. Aluminum wiring was put in the house when it was built. And so when I discovered that, I stripped out probably a third of the aluminum wiring in the house and replaced it with copper, and that required a lot of extra work to join aluminum to copper. So when I sit in the house, I can basically see through the walls and know what's behind there because I saw all of that. But most of you wouldn't care about that. Instead, what you're most interested in might be how it's made a home. When you buy a new house, what do? You move boxes into it, you organize it, you do all of this, you move things around until all the material stuff is put in its right place, the books are put on shelves, the clothes are put away in dressers in the right rooms, and when it's done, all the boxes are removed. And now you no longer have simply a house, but now you have your home. Genesis 1 and 2 is talking about how God is making a home for us. And when you get to the last day, the seventh day, it says God did what? God rested. Now, it's often puzzling to people why God, who's omnipotent like that, would need to rest. Was really creating for 6 days so strenuous, he needed to rest. And that's not the idea at all. The idea is more that now that God has finished constructing and building this place that will be his home, his resting is one of now living in it and engaging in it. Just as when God promised to David that he will give him rest from his enemies. He's saying now you will no longer have to toil against those others, but now you can have peace and get on with your normal life, getting on with life. Resting is not simply relaxation and sleeping. It's more about getting on with the normal activities of life. And so in the first chapters of Genesis, we see God creating this place, this home for us, and then resting on the seventh day. And you'll remember that that's also going to parallel other things we'll see later, that day seven becomes important. The Jews would, of course, remember the Sabbath day. And that's a day of not just resting from work, it's more a day about devoting oneself's thoughts and minds to God. And so that's more of what the Genesis story is about. God is creating a sacred space for himself. The temple then becomes sacred space later. So if we go to the New Testament time where Jesus is at, we know we have a temple there. The temple built by Herod, we'll talk more about that. But the question for the Jewish person in the first century was whether or not God had re-inhabited this second temple that Herod had built, or whether God had refused to come back and inhabit that temple. That's much of the debate that's going on in the first century. But we see this sort of an idea that God is creating this world for us, and he's doing so to have a relationship with us. But what he does also then is begin this relationship. And so it began with Adam and Eve, but what happens? Of course, Adam and Eve, they rebel, they sin. So in the garden, we have this immediate first problem where there is a sin that enters the world. Through the fall, of course, we now know there's a curse. And so because of this curse, there's an alienation from God, from man, an alienation of one from another. And there's this now true moral guilt that comes into the universe. And so now the people are separated from God and are now expelled from the garden. This shows us now in this Jewish theology that what's going on is that God now has separated his presence, his Edenic presence, his presence in Eden from these people. And now humanity after that is always trying to find a way of re-engaging with this divine, with God himself. Where can we find God? When you get to the end of the Bible, in Revelation 21, in particular 22, we see there a description of the new creation. A new creation is the ultimate eschatological promise, a promise for the future. And with that promise of the future, we see now the full presence of God, and there will be no temple because God will be everywhere. And so that's the end game. That's where it's all going. What the Jewish mind in the first century is wondering and thinking about is, how can we get God back on our side to get God's presence back among us? So we have the fall, and we see, you know, the consequences of that. Humanity is expelled from the garden. Well, then God comes in Genesis 3, chapter 15, and talks about a seed, that he will make a seed. And this seed will redeem humanity. You will bruise him on the heel. He'll bruise you on the head. The story being that this Redeemer will deal a fatal blow to evil, but that evil will only strike its heel, something that's not fatal. So the theme of redemption is known in the Jewish mind. They're thinking about redemption, what it is and how it might come. And of course, the first story of God's provision is that God made garments of skin for Adam and Eve, and he clothed them in Genesis 3:21. God provided for them. So that begins the story of Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3 with the fall. After that, chapters 4 through 11, we have this entire descent of humanity into a spiraling, cascading fall of shame and sin. And so there's a few stories that we see there. One is the story of Noah. In Genesis 6, we see the story of Noah, what God does there. The flood story is a picture again of God taking the disordered world that's now disordered from sin. Remember, we began with a God who created. And so the chaos of Genesis 1, 2 that speaks of this unformed void, the Hebrew tohu v'bohu, is a picture of this unformed void, this mass of chaos. God then forms, orders the world around that. So now we have in these 6 days the creation of humanity. The seventh day, God rests. In other words, God inhabits it. There is an ordering of the universe, and all is well. Sin disorders it. The flood now is God's way of unordering it, removing the disorder and bringing it back to more of its chaotic state, as Genesis 1:2 talks about, this chaotic flooded state where all of the disorder is now gone. So Genesis 6 with Noah becomes something of a recreation story. It's starting anew. It's not the end of the game. It's brand new again. And so the story of Noah and the flood is a picture of God telling us that he recreated again, but it didn't take long before this recreation again fell into sin. We know Noah and his sons and on and on. So between Genesis 6 and Genesis 11, we have stories there of just things going bad. And that's when we get to the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. In Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel is again a picture, a story that tells us about humanity. It says, building this tower in the sky. And we often think that the reason that they're building this tower is so that they can find their way up to God. They're trying to build a tower so they can make it up to where God's at. But if you understand the ancient way of thinking, you know it's actually the opposite. Instead, what they're doing is they're building a tower. They're building, well, remember, it happened in the land of Shinar, Genesis tells us, which is in the Mesopotamian Valley. And in that Mesopotamian Valley in those years, they built ziggurats. And you may know of a ziggurat, it's a pyramid-like sort of building with layers that go up. And when they built a ziggurat, they built it somewhere near a temple with the idea in the ancient world, this ancient pagan way of thinking, that you build the ziggurat and God will come down to you now. So the tower they're building is not so that they can go up to get God, but so that God can come down and they can now have God in their presence doing things for themselves. And that's why it says in Genesis 11 that the reason they built it was so that humanity could have a great name. They were not building it so that God would have a great name, but so that they themselves would have a great name. They're wanting the gods to come down to where they're at to serve them, so to be available to do what humans needed the gods to do for them. And so we see in this ancient Near Eastern way of thinking, this idea that we can control gods, we can make this sacred space. And that's where God, of course, disorders the languages. People can no longer talk with one another. What you see then at Pentecost, when the Spirit comes down at Pentecost, is the opposite of that, where the inability to communicate is overcome now, that people can understand the speaking in foreign languages. But for the ancient way of thinking, the gods and humans operated in something of this symbiotic sort of relationship. The gods did for me, and I did for the gods. And so as long as I do things for the gods to keep them happy, they'll do things for me to keep us happy by giving us rain, by giving us food. That's what we have in the ancient world. Archaeology has produced tens of thousands all over the world, fertility gods and all these other images, which are their way of appeasing and satisfying the gods that are above them. And so in Genesis 3, we see this sacred space lost in the fall. In Genesis 11, we see these people attempt to regain that. And God says no to that. Now, Genesis 1 to 11 forms something of a really tight unit. In fact, it's often referred to as primeval history. But those chapters, 1 to 11, form something of a great tight unit. When you go to chapter 12, Genesis 12, you turn a brand new page on the story of Abraham, and everything begins new there. We often think of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. These five books are called the Pentateuch. Pent means a five, like Pentagon. Pentateuch means five books, so we have five scrolls. Teuch means scrolls, actually. So we have these five scrolls. The last one, Deuteronomy, is different from the others. And so sometimes the Jewish people talk about the Tetrateuch, which is the four books, leaving Deuteronomy out because it's so different. Other times they'll talk about not only Deuteronomy, but Joshua, because Deuteronomy leads so tightly into the story of Joshua coming to the edge of the land and then conquering the land, that they would call it the Hexateuch. So we have the 4, 5, and 6, the Tetrateuch, Pentateuch, and Hexateuch, these books. But that shows you how tightly themed these six books really are, that they carry this one narrative so tightly. But Genesis 12, we know, goes through chapter 50 of Genesis. We often think that's the end of Genesis. When you go to Exodus, many years have passed. The Israelites have descended down into Egypt. They've now grown a great nation, and now God calls them out of that Egypt to become their own nation. But there's really more of a thematic continuity between Genesis 12, going all the way through Exodus, up to Exodus 19. So Genesis 12 through Exodus 19 is a story of Abraham, his son Isaac, and Jacob. The sons of Jacob become the nation of Israel. They're in Egypt. They're brought out of Egypt now to Mount Sinai. That's how God creates a nation. Genesis 12 to Exodus 19. In Exodus 19, now God comes and he now gives the law. And so Genesis 20, we have the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. Exodus 20 begins this whole theme that has to do with the law and regulations, purity regulations, how to live, what to do. Exodus 20 kind of goes forward through the end of Exodus chapter 40, but even straight on through Leviticus, all the way through Numbers 10. So Exodus 20 through Leviticus to Numbers 10, that's really a more tight unit. And in those three books, the last half of Exodus, Leviticus, and then Numbers, in those three books as it spans, the 600 laws are given that regulate the life of the Jewish people, how they're to live, what they're to do. We'll talk more about that, but that's how that goes. When you get to that point, again, Numbers 10, we now see that kind of works its way through Deuteronomy and even Joshua, because now we're moving towards a promised land. Deuteronomy is at the threshold of entering the land. The book of Deuteronomy is basically constructed out of three large speeches by Moses on what the law is, how it regulates our life, and how we're going to move into the promised land. And Joshua is the story of the conquest. So that's how the Jewish person kind of thinks about what's going on in these passages. But when we come to chapter 12, we see something new happening here. And here we see God now establishing his covenant with Abraham. He calls Abraham out of Ur, the Chaldees, which is in Mesopotamia. He goes northwest up the Mesopotamian River, which is through modern-day Iraq, and up north along the edge of the mountains, and then south into what becomes Israel. You have to make this northern loop and arc because straight across is straight across a very hostile desert. So most people would never cross across that Arabian desert. Instead, they go around it. The story that begins in Genesis 12 is the story of God calling Abraham and making him a great nation. And when you come to chapter 12, and I'm just going to read a few verses there, and we're going to kind of hit passages here and there a bit. We can't spend too much time on any of them. But Genesis chapter 12 is a story now of how God makes certain promises to build this nation that would become the Jewish people. In 12:1, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" This is the central theological understanding that the Jewish mind had. This now becomes that theological point that regulates, in many ways, much of what comes after. In fact, we see even this one commission that's given to Abraham in this covenant that he makes, that you will bless all the families of the earth through you, that becomes problematic for Israel. And that's why we have the other laws and the covenants that follow. And so I just want to remind us that we have these several covenants. Now, having said that, what's a covenant? A covenant can be described as an agreement, an arrangement into which two different parties enter a relationship. And it can get kind of complicated in different ways, so we'll try and not make it complicated. But it's a way of entering into a relationship. Now, the relationship can be between two parties who are of equal parity, like brothers. And so we can agree as brothers, and sometimes it's even as simple as a contract. Other times, the relationship differences might be so different that it's a superpower over someone with no power. And so there's bargaining positions that are different often. And so a covenant is a way that God is now coming to Abraham and telling Abraham that I have chosen you. The Tower of Babel failed because this was humanity's way of trying to manipulate the gods for their own benefit. But Abraham, I've chosen you and through you to build a nation, to build a people through which I can then have a relationship and through which I can then bless the world. And so it's going to be through Abraham and his seed. So Genesis 12 talks about this call of Abraham, the first moments of this Abrahamic covenant being made known in those verses. And then we know some things happen. Abraham goes into, we have Sarah in Egypt, they descend to Egypt. Abraham and Lot have their story. When we come to Genesis 15 now, we have this covenant again more formalized. And so in Genesis 15, we begin in verse 1. "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. 'Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great.' For Abram said, 'O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus.' And Abram said, 'Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir.' And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, 'This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir.' And he brought him outside and said, 'Look toward the heaven, the number of the stars, if you are able to number them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' And he, Abraham, believed the Lord, and God counted it to him as righteousness. So Abraham's faith in trusting in God is now counted to him as righteousness. That passage is then picked up by Paul and used several times in Paul in Galatians and Romans. We'll talk about that in due course. But we see that theme now, Abraham believing God. So God has come to Abraham and promised he'll make him a great nation. He'll do this for him. He's going to give him a land. He's going to bless his people. He will have a great nation follow him. But Abraham has a problem. He's married to an old woman. And so he is himself. They've not had a child. Now they're old. So what does Sarah do? Sarah decides now that she can't bear. She hands Hagar, in chapter 16, Hagar to Abraham to have a child. And so Abraham, his name is changed to Abraham later, of course, but Abram has a child with Hagar, who becomes Ishmael. This was Abraham's way of, quote, helping God get out of this mess. God had promised to make him a great nation. Knowing that Sarah couldn't have a child, Abraham and Sarah got together, said, well, we can work around that. We'll use Hagar instead. That will be my heir. And God, of course, comes to Abraham and says, that's not how we're going to do it. So when Genesis 17 starts, we have God coming to him again, and now we have this Abrahamic covenant reaffirmed again. It's sort of this recommissioning of this covenant in Genesis 17. When Abram was 99 years old, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you, and may multiply you greatly. Then Abram fell on his face. We see the story continuing there. God says, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And so this covenant is reaffirmed, it's promised, and it's said that God will do it his way. And of course, Sarah has a son, who is Isaac. The promise of the seed goes to Isaac. It'll eventually go to Jacob. It goes to Isaac in chapter 26. It goes to Jacob in chapter 46. We see the picture there of God fulfilling this Abrahamic covenant, this promise to make him a great nation, to bless them, and to give them a land. That is what's in the mind of the Jewish people in the first century when they're dominated now by the Romans, having been dominated prior by the Greeks, prior to that by the Persians, prior to that by the Babylonians, prior to that by the Assyrians. For now 600 some years, the Jewish people in the first century, by then they have been dominated by foreign nations for 600 years. But they kept looking back to this Abrahamic covenant as the promise that would help them, that would fix them, that would rescue them. And so they see that continually throughout, that God will make this covenant and will keep this covenant. So he reveals himself to them and promises that he will do this for them. And so in this covenant, we see seed, we see land, all of this being promised. In Genesis 15 and 17, we see two iterations of this covenant, 17 more elaborate, and that it appears to be because of the events of 16 with Hagar. And so God says, Hagar is not the way with Ishmael, but Sarah will be with Isaac. And so we see this covenant being made, what is often called an unconditional covenant. But by that it means simply that there are some parts to it which God will fulfill as God has promised, as God has said. Now, the purpose of the Abrahamic covenant is so that there might be blessing, the idea of blessing and land. If you go back to Genesis 1, very early there, we see already a description there that God blessed what had been done in creation. So blessing started Genesis 1. God promises to reinstitute his blessing through Abraham in chapter 12. We see in Genesis 1, God giving humanity through Adam and Eve, giving them a land, a place to live, to be, and dwell with God. We see that being lost, but God then restarting with Abraham saying that I will now give you a land, a place that you can be. And so throughout this time, there's always this ongoing battle of rebellion and disobedience. Nevertheless, even though disobedience brings a curse, God promises that he will do what he has promised. But through all of this, there is what becomes in the theological thinking of the Jewish people, this idea of exile. They have been exiled. And again, if we go to the first century, the world in which Jesus lived, the Jewish people have been in exile. We'll talk about this more in the coming weeks, but separated from their land when they were taken to Assyria, when they were taken to Babylon, even though they were allowed to return after the Babylonian captivity, to return to Israel, they still felt like they were in exile because they were still under, initially, the Persian control, and then after that, the Greeks, and then after that, the Romans. And for only a short time in the Hasmonean period did the Jewish people actually rule the Jewish people. But those were Jewish people that were more Greek than Jews, and so for many Jews it didn't even count. So they saw themselves in exile. Their entire struggle was to look to the promises that God had made and see these promises being made, believing that God would then fulfill them, that he would bring them out of exile and give them their land, give them their place. So we see all of this going on in the Abrahamic covenant. And we'll talk more about this again. In other words, we'll see this pop up throughout the theology of Israel as it develops in the prophets, as we'll see, and what are called in the Jewish Bible, the writings, throughout this idea that God has made a promise. Even in the Abrahamic covenant, there's a promise there that there will be a great land and a great people. Now, the second great covenant that comes along is the Mosaic covenant. So we'll talk briefly about this tonight as well. The Abrahamic covenant is made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob's sons, Jacob's name changed to Israel. His children, the children of Israel. At the end of Genesis, they descend into Egypt, where they grow into a great nation. We turn Exodus 1. We see there now they are a large people. And now God comes to Moses and said, I'm going to use you to bring this people out of slavery into the promised land. And so we know the story there of the plagues that happened, of Moses' confrontation with Pharaoh. Eventually, after the 10th plague, we have the Passover story in which the Jewish people sacrificed a lamb with the blood on the doorpost or the post outside the door. God passed over those homes and only took the firstborn of the Egyptians. But through this, God was able to bring his people out of Egypt and initially into the Sinai Peninsula, but eventually into the Promised Land. So to the Jewish mind now, and we know we studied the book of Exodus last year or so for about a year, you know the general story there. There's a lot of interesting parts to it. But the simple basic story that God delivered us from slavery to the Egyptians becomes a powerfully important theme in their mind. In Exodus, the rationale for not working on the Sabbath is because that's the day that God rested. In Deuteronomy, when the law is reaffirmed after those 40 years in the desert, when Deuteronomy talks about why they obey the Sabbath, it's not because God rested, it's because God delivered us from slavery in Egypt. That's the rationale for it. And so we enjoy the Sabbath as a way of remembering what God did for us in delivering us from slavery in Egypt. That idea in the Jewish mind that God can deliver from slavery and bring freedom again, bring us back to the blessed place of promise, that never leaves the Jewish way of thinking, their Jewish mind. They're always looking to that. So now let's talk briefly about this Mosaic covenant. It's called the Mosaic covenant because Moses becomes the mediator of it. God comes to Moses and says to Moses, I'm going to make a promise through you, and this is what it's about. And so God will describe it in Exodus. It's also called the Sinai covenant because it happens in Sinai out there in the desert. In the New Testament, it's called the Old Covenant. And we'll see it called the Old Covenant there and other things as well. But a number of things happen. Now, again, we talked about what happens in Exodus 19 there as something new. The Israelites now arrive at Sinai. They've now been out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, into Sinai. They finally make their way to Mount Sinai there. And this is where God comes in chapter 19, and he charges them to listen to my voice and keep my covenant, do what I say. And so immediately we're faced with God calling Moses up to the mountain where he first gives him the Ten Commandments that are called the Decalogue, the ten words. Deca means ten, so the Decalogue, these ten words are given to Moses, the Ten Commandments as we know them. In Exodus 20, 1 to 17, we see the commandments given. We see a parallel version also given in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 4 and following, which elaborates on them in somewhat greater detail. Moses is made the mediator, and with these Ten Commandments, this Decalogue, we have the first law being laid before the Israelites. Do these things. So that we have it on the table initially, let's remember that the reason God is giving the Jews, the Israelites, these laws is so that they will have a means of separating themselves and being holy. They're called to be holy people. This is in part what it's about. It's a means of now entering into that place with God of holiness. So God then gives them that. There's other parts given in chapter 20, 21, and 22, which is called the covenantal code. And you can see that in your Bibles. We went through that in Exodus before. But again, all the way through Numbers 10, there's a series of laws given. The book of Leviticus is a very detailed explication of the laws, of the purity laws, of how to approach God, of what all of these things. These are the laws, the way of thinking that troubled the Jews of the first century. And that's why we have eventually the rise of different sects called the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the Zealots, and other groups. Many of these groups in many ways, there's another group called the Therapeutae, which are only mentioned from a manuscript found in Egypt. But all of these groups are in one way or another debating, discussing how to apply these laws, what this is all about. Now, Leviticus has many of its laws, which are called purity laws. And the purity laws, as we mentioned before, are not about hygiene. It's not specifically about washing your hands and not having contamination that way. It's about things being separated. So we'll talk more about this later. But there's sacred parts and there's common things, sacred things and common things. There's clean and unclean. All of these different purity laws. And so, by way of example, in John, we see in John chapter 2, at the marriage at the wedding at Cana, the six jars that are used there in which Jesus now turns water into wine. Those are stone jars, not clay jars. The reason they're stone jars is because under the Jewish purity system, stone could maintain purity, but clay would be contaminated. And so once clay is contaminated, it can never be uncontaminated, so it has to be destroyed. Stone, if it's contaminated, can become clean again. And so it's not about hygiene. It's not about germ theory as such. It's more about this idea of what's separate unto God. And so these ideas now show up. And this is much of the debate. In Mark chapter 7, there's a story there of Jesus and his disciples walking through the grain fields. And his disciples are plucking grain and eating on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees jump out and challenge him. How can you do this? And Jesus, now, without washing your hands. So the Pharisees were challenging him on purity grounds. And Jesus now challenges them on that, basically saying that this whole idea of the purity law, I'm getting rid of that. I'm supplanting all of these regulations that have so bound you up. I'm showing you a different way. And so that becomes then much of the message of what is going through the gospel stories as we see them. So we see these stories. Again, Deuteronomy, if you've not read through Deuteronomy lately, maybe you can this week. It's a great cut. So read through there. It's a story. Remember, Moses called by God. What was Moses' excuse for not going? Say, I can't talk well. I mumble. I'm not a good speaker. When you get to Deuteronomy, you find out that that's all cured by now, because these are three long speeches of Moses that are beautiful and eloquent. And as Moses lays out for the Israelites what their obligations will be as they enter into the promised land. So we have the Mosaic covenant being made, the law being a part of that. We have the Abrahamic covenant already in place. And so you might wonder, what happens to the Abrahamic covenant if we now have the Mosaic covenant? And there is a way that they work together. God gives the Mosaic covenant, and through that we see the book of Deuteronomy. Eventually from that we see a new covenant being promised. We'll talk about next week. But there is continuity with the Abrahamic covenant as well. In Genesis 15 and Genesis 17, God promised a land, promised a people. The Mosaic covenant maintains continuity by showing the people how to maintain God's blessing by obeying the law and maintaining this national holiness. And so, real briefly, I'm going to turn over to Deuteronomy 28, 27, 28, and 29. So, in 27, there's a number of curses that come down at 28 and 29. And maybe sometime you can read this, but this is God talking about the blessings for obedience and the curses for disobedience. In 28, Deuteronomy 28, if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you this day, the Lord your God will set you on high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of the ground, and the fruit of your cattle, and the increase of your herds, and the young of your flocks. Blessed shall be your basket. And I'll stop there. It goes on for many, many verses more, talking about all the blessings which follow if you keep these commands, follow these laws. But in Deuteronomy 28:15, it turns. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God and be careful to do all his commandments and all his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field, and cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your womb and the fruit of the ground and the increase of your herds. And he goes on from there. So in the Jewish mind, they know that if they obey, God will bring his blessing. If they disobey the commands made in this Mosaic covenant, then God will bring curses. The Abrahamic covenant tells us that God will still make sure there's a way. But individually and as a nation, even these people can bring themselves under God's curse. And so because of their eventual sin, and we'll now talk briefly about Israel's coming history, we know after they enter the land, we have Joshua. They maintain the land. We have the judges for a period. Eventually, we have the Israelites now wanting a king. And so Saul is made the first king. He fails. God cuts off his family. God then goes to David. And David becomes a king. After him, Solomon. Solomon builds a temple. But Solomon's two sons divide the kingdom. And so the United Kingdom is really only maintained under David and Solomon. After that, it's divided into Israel in the north and Judah in the south. The Israelites of the north are, because of its disobedience, brings the curse of God down, and they're punished by being carried away by the Assyrians in the year 722. The Judeans of the south, when they fall into disobedience, are curses come down. They're punished by being taken by the Babylonians in about the year 587. This now, in the Jewish mind, is the consequence of their father's sins. When the Jews of Jesus' day look back on Israel's history, they see the divided kingdom being carried away into captivity, into exile, because of sin. But there's still that promise of Deuteronomy 28, which says, if you obey and follow my law, then you will be blessed. And that's where they're always at, and they're thinking, if we obey, we can bring God's blessing. Now, I alluded briefly to David in 2 Samuel 7, and we'll end with this in a few minutes, but in 2 Samuel 7, we see David coming, we see God coming to David and making a covenant with David, that in David, he will be a great kingdom. And the story begins in chapter 7 with this, verses 1 to 3, 2 Samuel 7. Now when the king, David, lived in his house This is after David set up his great house in Jerusalem. And the Lord had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies. There's that word rest again. The king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent." And Nathan said to the king, "Go and do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." So David sees that he's got this great palace, but that the Ark of the Covenant, representing God, is still in the tent. So now David wants to build a temple. But that same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, "Go and tell my servant David," God says, "thus says the Lord, would you build me a house to dwell in?" God asks. "I have not lived in a house since the day I brought the people out of Israel from Egypt to this day. But I have been moving about in the tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar?" So God's saying, you know, I've not had a house for a long time. I'm not concerned about that right now. Verse 8, "Now therefore, thus you should say to my servant David." So God tells Nathan, "Tell David this. I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be a prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went and have cut off all your enemies before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house." God will make David a house. So David begins by saying, we should make a house for God. God comes and says, no, I'm going to make a house for you, a kingdom for you. The Davidic kingdom is promised. And so this Davidic covenant becomes the third piece of the theology of the Jewish mind in the first century. It is that God promised that his kingdom will reign through David and his seed. So after David and on through, we see this promise that there will be a Davidic messianic ruler, a king that will come and deliver the Israelite people. We'll see next week more of this discussion of this messianic promise in Psalm 89 and in other places, but there's this promise of a coming Messiah. The Jewish person in the first century is thinking of these promises. God made a promise to Abraham to give us a blessing and to give us a land and make us a people. That through Moses, if we obey, he will do that. And through David, that he will give us a king, a kingdom, and a Messiah. When Jesus comes now, that's what Jesus says he is. He is that coming Davidic king. He is that coming Davidic Messiah that you've been looking for. The problem is, between the time that these events happened with David, about the year 1000 BC, 1,000 years of Jewish history will pass before Jesus shows up on the scene. And in that 1,000 years, this simple theology that we see in these books becomes contorted and twisted. And so the Jewish worldview is fractured in many different ways. We'll talk about more of that next week. Tonight we wanted just to introduce basically these theological themes, to put these on the table. In coming weeks, we'll talk more history, the historical developments, how these events played out, and how history affects the way people think, their theology. What we are and how we think and believe is often shaped by the world in which we're born, by the culture in which we live, and by the forces around us. And that's no less true of us than it is of the Israelites of the first century. So return next week. We'll talk about the Davidic covenant, picking that up into the new covenant, and then see as that shapes the Jewish people going forward. So we'll end with that tonight and pick up next week on these additional themes. Our Father, we thank you for this time tonight that we can look into your word and see the promises that you made not only to the Israelites, but to us as well, that all the nations of the earth will be blessed through your chosen seed, which we know to be now Christ himself. And we know that we are blessed in Christ and enjoy that blessing that you promised to Abraham so long ago. So we thank you for that and praise you for that, for it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.